Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks very much for listening. Welcome to the program for Friday, February 20th, 2015. It is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. And we have a newcomer and a veteran on the Federal News Countdown this week. My veteran is Ron Sanders of Booz Allen. It's great to see you, my friend. Thanks for being on. Happy to have you on the program this week. And my newcomer is Jim Carafano of the Heritage Foundation. He's director of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at Heritage and author of Wiki at War, Conflict in a Socially Networked World. Jim, thank you very much for doing this
today. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you on. Your colleague Steve Bucci is now a regular on the countdown, and I trust that he has. I hope he's schooled you up as far as what
he never
to expect.
Talks to me. You know, we're West Point classmates too. You think the bond there, the duty, honor, country thing would play out, but not so much.
I owe Steve a big talking to, I suppose. Well, it's great to have you here. Thank you for coming, and I appreciate both of you being on. You have each chosen what you believe are the three most important news stories this week for folks who work in the federal government, and we'll start where we always do with
number three.
And Jim, your choice at number three is from Reuters, and it's the story of the horrible situation in Libya with 21 Egyptians who lost their lives in a beheading there, Coptic Christians. And this situation has created an interesting dynamic in foreign policy, diplomacy, and military circles here in Washington.
Well, Jim, I picked this story because I think more than other, it really illustrates in an incredibly powerful way what's going to be happening here on the homeland. I think that the demand on the home front in the Homeland Security enterprise, so people that are working in that space, in the FBI, in DHS, in these other agencies, they're going to be spending more and more time looking for people linked to this group, and that's going to be a growth area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to impact on a lot of things. It's going to impact on the upcoming debate we're going to have on reauthorizing intelligence programs, the FISA debate, the court that oversees domestic surveillance and issues warrants. It's going to impact on that. That's going to have an impact on investigations, on authorities, on how to investigate. It's going to transcend down to the state and local level. It's going to wind up getting kind of rolled into issues with that we dealt with recently in Ferguson and the police in our communities and how we deal with our communities. Matter of fact, I just had a very personal experience on that. I was out in St. Louis where they arrested a handful of people from the Bosnian community who were involved in providing material support to ISIS fighters in Syria. And the local community was absolutely shocked that this had happened. Just a blow to the whole St. Louis community, who has a very integrated Islamic community, lots of mosques, really never had any issues, really kind of shook them to the core. But one of the things talking to the Bosnian leaders was, you know, hey, we work with the FBI all the time. You know, it's not a big deal here. So these are the same communities that were dealing with the problems of Ferguson. So it gets really complicated. But I just think this is going to put so much more in their screen. And you really have to watch the videos to really understand the threat that these guys. So the victims wear orange suits. That's payback for Gitmo. Mm-hmm. They're saying, like, you humiliate us.
And Abu Ghraib, too.
That's right. We're going to humiliate you. The victims go compliantly into the execution. You go, well, why is that? Well, you know, they put them through so many mock executions that they don't know that that's their last day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's designed to make them look submissive and subservient, right?
The Homeland Security element here, too, is troubling because we're about exactly a week away from a potential shutdown of the Homeland Security Department.
Yeah, and I don't see any sense in Congress to avoid this crisis. I mean, I don't really get any sense that anybody is really looking to avoid a showdown here.
Hmm.
So, what we're more than likely to see is most of the workforce will stay on the job. People might have their pay deferred.
Yeah.
My guess is
not might, they will.
Yeah. Well, and my guess is not very long. But there's not a clear political way out of this. Congress doesn't seem to be interested in any hurry to find one. And I think the recent court ruling, which the Biden administration has just asked for a stay on the court ruling on the implementation of the executive amnesty process, I think that's actually kind of propelled people more towards the cliff here. And so these things are going to be happening at the same time.
Jim Carafano's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is from Reuters, and it is headlined, Egypt bombs Islamic State targets in Libya after 21 Egyptians beheaded. Ron, your choice at number three is from the Federal Times. It's Andy Medici's story, headlined, Scandal-plagued VA fires more feds in fiscal 2014. And this has been an interesting back and forth this week. There was a story that we saw from another source, and I don't recall it now, that kind of mixed the numbers. That maybe it was GovExec that compared calendar 14 and fiscal 2013 to look at the trajectory at VA. Andy's story, it appears to me, is more apples to apples, where it's comparing fiscal years. And when you do that, it appears VA is letting more people go. There's one number here that jumped out at me, but I wonder what you saw in this story that you thought was especially important.
Well, Francis, I think there's bad news, good news, and cautionary news in
okay.
this story. Here's the bad news. The numbers notwithstanding, and look, when you put the numbers in perspective, this is a very, very small percentage of the VA workforce, and the increase is a very, very small percentage of that. That's not intended to comment on the merits of that number. I don't know whether that's too big, too small, just right.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the bad news here is the focus on the numbers. And further down in the story, there's a focus on the number of senior executives that have been fired, which, again, is a very small number. And I think the expectations, in part from the legislation that was passed last year, have been we want to see more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bad news here. That's what I begin to worry about, is when this becomes a numbers game, not cases on the individual merits, not a culture of accountability, what gets measured gets done. And there's always the risk of over-rotating. I'll come back to that.
Uh-huh.
To me, the good news is buried in the story. Way down near the bottom, it says that 91% of VA's medical facilities have new leaders or leadership teams. I'll hearken back to my IRS experience now 15 years ago or so. We were faced with problems similar to the VA, and in fact, I've talked to a number of VA officials, and they too see the parallels. And frankly, one of the most powerful things we did at IRS way back then was essentially change out our leadership corps. We made all of our GS-15s and senior executives recompete for their jobs under the new organization structure against a new set of criteria. We wanted to make sure that they were with the transformation,
mm-hmm.
that they were going to support it. And a lot of this has been behind the curtain, but I'm encouraged by that number, not because the old leaders were bad, but because in any sort of transformation, you need to refresh your leadership core. And the fact that this apparently is going on, to me, is a very good thing. One last, I'll go to the cautionary tale and back to the bad news. If this becomes a numbers game, think about the effect that has on the behavior of VA employees and, in particular, VA leaders. We saw examples of this when I was in the intelligence community. If there's one sure way to make your employees, your workforce, and your leadership core as risk-averse as humanly possible, it is to send the message that this is all about the numbers and we're going to be looking for symbolic gestures and scapegoats. Well, the best way to avoid that is to turn turtle and not make the tough calls, and especially in a transformation as significant as VA's, mm-hmm. you got to make some tough calls.
The number that jumped out at me in this story, Ron, is out of the 2,572 employees fired in fiscal 2014, 2,426 of them, about 94%, were from VHA, the Veterans Health Administration. I don't know why that seems significant to me. I don't know what the meaning is behind that, but that seems like that should be noteworthy, like people should be paying attention to that for some reason, that there weren't more folks from VBA or from the other parts of the agency that were let go.
And certainly the VHA side has been more dramatic with mm-hmm. the wait times and everything else.
Sure.
But that's an astute observation, because the VBA side has certainly been in the spotlight.
They've had their share of problems.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not been a positive spotlight. And, yeah, you have to wonder whether things are fixed there. I say that with a bit of tongue-in-cheek, or whether again, because of the scrutiny on the Hill and in the media, the focus has shifted to the hospital side when it should be, again, balanced.
Ron Sanders' choice as the third most important federal news story of the week is from the Federal Times. Scandal-plagued VA fires more feds in fiscal 2014. That story and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Ron Sanders and Jim Carafano. The countdown continues in just a moment. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories as selected by Ron Sanders and Jim Carafano. And we are up to
number two.
And Jim, your choice at number two this week is from Fox News. Obama says world should address grievances that terrorists exploit. A lot of controversy about President Obama's remarks, not just in the speech that you're talking about here, this summit that he convened on global terrorism, but just in the last couple of weeks. What do the people who execute policy and who execute diplomacy on an ongoing basis do with this kind of controversy and do with the ramifications of the controversy,
well,
do you think, Jim?
I picked this story because I'm evil, right? So you would read this story and say, if you're a contractor or you're an NGO or you're in the State Department or, you know, in HHS or something, you say, oh, this is awesome. We're going to be doing all these new programs. We're going to be outreach and building civil society, and we're going to be doing nutrition programs and you know, voter programs and religious freedom and empowering women and economic aid programs. And none of that's going to happen. Look, I mean, this was just a conference. I mean, if you look, the administration has done almost none of these initiatives, the kind of initiatives the programs talk about. None of them have really been part of our regional strategy the last 6 years. You look in what's in the budget this year, there's no new money for any of this stuff. So you know what? I hate to break this in a breaking news thing, but this was a conference.
Mm-hmm.
This was not anything.
So it's not reasonable for people to read into this any more than is there, it sounds like,
they should read in less than is there. I mean, I think, you know, economic freedom is a good example. Tunisia is the birthplace of the Arab Spring. The Tunisians have actually been one of the few countries to muddle through. They had a Muslim Brotherhood government, which backed down after the Muslim Brotherhood was thrown out of Cairo. They've got a very active civil society. They had a successful election. There's enormous appetite in Tunisia to do more with the United States, do more with the U.S. government, do a free trade agreement, you know, build on the program that the small program that the State Department does have. There's almost no plans for that. Almost none of that's going to happen. It's all just talk.
Ron, when these kinds of things happen, no matter the administration, no matter the policy that's being discussed, is this just a keep your head down moment for the personnel inside, example, where you were at ODNI? We're just going to keep our noses to the grindstone and keep going along with the day-to-day?
Yeah, so it's not so much keep your head down as keep your focus forward.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There's still a mission. These things happen. You read about them in the paper. They pass. Some actions may come of them. Some may not. I'll let others judge this one. We'll let historians judge this one. But I think for the frontline folks, if it's a blip on the radar screen, it's just that. Focus forward, especially for this community, the counterterrorism community.
The complications that I see potentially coming out of this too, Jim, primarily revolve around the fact that regardless of who President Obama's successor is, whatever we say or do for the next 2 years, somebody else will say or do something different 2 years from now.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. I do think that for the next 2 years, though, where the workforce is going to be focusing on is kind of the core hardcore CT kind of missions. That kind of activity is going to, you know, continue and going to really accelerate. The other stuff, I really think there's not going to be any kind of bold new broadening initiatives. There's not going to be a Marshall Plan. There's not going to be any of this other stuff. And then the new guys or the new girls going to come in. But there are some fundamental issues here that have to be addressed. Fundamentally, economic freedom is really vital to the Middle East if we're ever going to break through the large issues which would have existed regardless of ISIS, you know, regardless of Al-Qaeda. Property, Egypt's probably the great case study of this. Property rights are very poor. Corruption's rampant. The ability to start a business is very difficult. Unemployment's extraordinarily high. These issues fundamentally have to be addressed, and they're important. So a good example is look at Libya. Okay, foreign fighters are rushing to fight with Syria. Some of those guys are just getting paid. I mean, they're literally dollar day ISIS. They go because there's a paycheck. So there's a jobs program that actually is working on terrorism. But other people from are going actually have jobs, and they're actually considered relatively middle class. But the point is they don't really have opportunity. There isn't entrepreneurship. There isn't the ability to envision a larger. So there isn't, you know, the competing narrative really is to Islamism is Western modernity. I mean, that's the only other competing narrative really out there. And there really is an opportunity to kind of exercise that broadly throughout the Middle East, other than in places like Bahrain and Qatar and some of the Gulf Coast states. And even there, they're not immune to problems. So then the next president's going to have a big issue to help address. But there's going to be nothing to build on.
Mm-hmm. Ron, there's a sidebar here that's mentioned in this story, kind of alluded to in a roundabout way, that I have been following and find really fascinating. The story says, State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf has also come under fire for suggesting several times this past week that more jobs could help address the terrorism crisis. It's not her comments so much as it is the fact that she's a woman. Jen Psaki, who was the spokeswoman at the State Department until just a couple of days ago, we learned she's going back to the White House, also a woman. And especially Ms. Psaki, has come under a tremendous scrutiny from, of all places, the Russian media. They're writing about her in very derisive ways. And the sense that I take away from most of the commentary is just that she's a woman. And I think it's interesting to watch the dynamic of our State Department spokespeople who happen to be females and the attention that draws completely separate from whatever it is that they're talking about the policy of the administration or the policy of the department. It's interesting commentary to me on where we are compared to some of the countries that we're dealing with throughout the world.
Well, look, frankly, I'm quite proud of the fact that we don't let that potential criticism, and in fact, we probably know it's coming, we don't let that stop us from putting the people out front who are, or should be out front, whether they're male or female. If they're the spokesperson, they're the spokesperson, and we don't worry about that sort of blowback. I think if there's ever a case of stay on message, it's that, stay on message. Because I like the point that you were making, that at some point, words have to become deeds.
Yeah, the Russian thing's something else. The Russian thing is part of a conscious Russian propaganda campaign, which is integrated by the part of the government which uses Russian media, which seeks to undermine the legitimacy of the United States and its spokesperson, and particularly tries to tie them to conspiracy theories and everything else. So it's just, you're the person that's standing there, and I don't think it would matter if you're a man or a woman. They're going to look for some way to spin it that, you know, Americans are up to evil.
Jim, your choice at number two is headlined, Obama Says World Should Address Grievances That Terrorists Exploit. It's from Fox News, and it's linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Ron, your choice at number two is my colleague Emily Kopp's story from federalnewsradio.com, 5 Things Every Federal Employee Should Know About the Obama Budget. And we have this argument, my colleague Jason Miller and I. This is a very friendly discussion, I guess I should call it, rather than argument.
That's not how you got the black eye then.
No, that's a whole different issue, which we won't talk about on the radio. Every February or so, when we either get or anticipate the budget request, he and I have these discussions about how much we should get excited about the release of the budget request. I tend to be more on the reserved side of it's going to look completely different by the time it turns into something than what it looks like when it comes out of the White House. He is always very excited about it. And I don't think either one of us is necessarily right or wrong. It's just a different approach. So in that context, then, if I'm a federal employee and I'm looking at this, at these 5 things that this story covers, should I be worried? Should I just be staying informed? What's kind of the lens that I should look at these issues through, do you think, Ron?
Look, I think, especially given most recent history, most federal employees look at this sort of pensively. This is the opening move. We don't know what's going to come out of the sausage factory. You know, the good news is the president has proposed a pay increase. He's done that before. What's uncertain is how Congress is going to react. I do think it's gone on long enough, and the context has changed. The economy's improved. The deficit's been reduced. I do think you are hearing a Republican Congress look favorably at what is a modest pay increase. So let me turn the page. A lot of this depends on your job title, because 1.3%, if you're a cybersecurity expert, and we're going to talk about that in our next segment, is literally next to nothing. In fact, we know that the labor market for cybersecurity experts, computer scientists, computer engineers, and lots of other categories, not just IT cyber, have continued to increase far more than the gross averages of the employment cost index, which this is in theory based on. There are other job categories that have stayed level, and 1.3% may actually be okay. And of course, Francis, we all know, you know, that hidden in all of that is the irregular pay bumps that federal employees get on the basis of tenure.
Mm-hmm.
To me, what underscores, what I think is important here is it underscores just how broken the federal pay system is, because the 1.3% satisfies no one. More importantly, it doesn't really affect the government's ability to recruit and retain the best and brightest, which is what this should be about. There is a nugget of good news here in that the administration, for the first time, has started talking about we got to fix the general schedule. Emily didn't report that in the story because it is a well-buried nugget,
mm-hmm.
but it's an encouraging one because GAO has said the same thing. Last year, Congressman Isis and
Isa.
I'm sorry.
It's a Freudian slip if ever I've heard one.
You know, commissioned the GAO.
Osama, Obama,
exactly.
I won't go there, but he commissioned the GAO to look at the general schedule, knowing what the answer would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to think that the Republican majority knows it's broken. And my hope is that that nugget will be one of those things that is worth Jason getting excited about.
one of your colleagues at Heritage, and I apologize profusely, I don't remember his name, has done extensive work on the pay situation in the federal workforce.
James Shirk.
Yeah, yes, that's you're correct. That's who I was thinking. It was right on the tip of the tongue and wouldn't come out.
I knew that.
But if there's one thing everybody agrees on, whether they agree with his analysis or other analyses that we've seen, everybody seems to agree, Jim, that as Ron talked about, the pay situation doesn't work. It's not beneficial to the government. We were talking about it in kind of a roundabout way before we went on about cybersecurity personnel and the fact that the attrition level is so high because they realize there are other, better, greater opportunities for them out there.
Yeah, so the question is this the year that something actually gets done? Because the pressure to break out from under BCA is really getting very intense.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows the political way to do that. And of course the Congress and the administration are really working at odds at this. I mean, so this is ironic in the sense that I think the Congress would love to get past BCA. The administration would love to get past BCA, but rather than being the perfect kind of formula for bipartisanship, it's actually not, because they want to get out of it for very different reasons and they want to do very, very different things.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is where I need my time machine. You know, I need to go forward a year so I can come back and sound really smart about how this is all going to break out. I don't think we really know. So these kinds of issues, which are really critical in the workforce management thing, I don't know how that plays out when they're grappling with the big things. It's going to be, I'm not sure this is the year that kind of stuff really gets addressed.
I think the sense that a lot of people have is that these are exactly the kinds of things that, because they're important but not as important as some of the bigger things, just kind of continue along the way that they are. I just kind of keep going.
Well, you know
going.
Me, I'm an eternal optimist, and I think the fact that it is not on that everyone's top 10 hit parade for different reasons may actually offer some hope here.
You may be right. You may be right, but it just depends on how the politics of this all break out and mm-hmm. who's in the room when they're crafting whatever the heck.
I mean, this may actually be something both sides can agree on.
Well, right. That's so. Where I wanted to go is what do you see that causes that optimism that because it's under the radar screen, that the right people who are willing to make compromises will be the ones who pay attention to it instead of people who pay attention to it and say, who cares about that? We'll just leave it the way it is for now.
Well, first of all, it is largely structural. So there are changes that the administration and the Congress could make that would spend that 1.3% far more wisely than it's going to get spent peanut right. butter across the slice of bread.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in part because of some of the threats we've been talking about this afternoon, and we will talk about in a few minutes, we know we're lagging. We know there is a talent gap. We know that talent gap has serious consequences. I'll give everyone a movie trailer. You know, if the federal government's going to be the sheriff in town in mm-hmm. the internet, that sheriff is outmanned and outgunned at the moment. And there are ways to fix this that don't cost a ton of money, mm-hmm. that just reallocate existing resources. I've had occasion to talk to lots of sub-cabinet officials in this administration, and surprisingly enough, they will cite human capital as one of their biggest challenges, their ability to recruit and retain talent as one of their biggest challenges. So when you have a whole slew of Democratic appointees essentially saying the same thing that many in Congress who've spent some time focusing on this are saying— again, I'm an eternal optimist. I'll hold out for hope.
I love the glass half full, Ron. Ron Sanders' choice is the second most important federal news story of the week is from Federal News Radio. It's Emily Kopp's story headline, 5 Things Every Federal Employee Should Know About the Obama Budget. You can read it and all of our countdown stories linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Jim Carafano of Heritage and Ron Sanders of Booz Allen next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. This is In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the 3 most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Jim Carafano of the Heritage Foundation and Ron Sanders of Booz Allen Hamilton. And we are up to, on this week's countdown,
#1.
And Jim, your choice is the most important federal news story of the week is from The Guardian. The headline is Leaders Discuss Crumbling Ukraine Ceasefire as Fighting Continues. It's the ceasefire that isn't really a ceasefire, is what it appears to be.
It's the non-ceasefire.
And what the layer beneath this, you can read in this story about what's happening as late as yesterday morning in this, and of course updates since then. But what appears to have driven the ceasefire in the first place was the administration's at least potential interest in supplying some kind of support to Poroshenko's government in Kiev. Not too long after that, European leaders met. Putin agreed to the ceasefire, and we are where we are. What I wonder is, what's the implication of somebody at the Pentagon who has to be responsible for putting together this support effort when we're seeing the kind of discussions that we're already seeing about sequestration, how it affects readiness, how it affects systems that are in place and all of that jazz, when we're looking at a $498 billion top line and maybe $34 billion coming off the top?
Yeah, this is my wake up, smell the coffee choice. Yeah, really, because people that think that the U.S. military industrial complex is done with Western Europe, they're just wrong. This problem is going to fester. It's going to grow. The administration really doesn't have good answers, but there's going to be, like the quicksand, there's going to be this inevitable sucking of U.S. military engagement in Western Europe in a way that we just didn't foresee just a few years ago. And the fantasy of the pivot or divot or whatever you want to call it, that, you know, all our attention is going to go in Asia and we don't have to worry about Europe anymore, that is so, so dead. And if you didn't believe it, read this story, then you'll believe it. So a good example is A-10s are going back into Europe. So we were getting rid of A-10s because we couldn't afford them under sequester. That was completely unacceptable. So not only are we not getting rid of A-10s, we're actually deploying them to Western Europe of all places. And I think all the, you know, everybody that was closing the doors, putting on the padlocks, you know, waving goodbye, saying, oh, I'll never see Stuttgart again. You know, guess again, folks, because I think contractors are heading back. I think folks are heading back. Planners are heading back. Forces are heading back. I eventually, my guess is there's going to be some kind of military assistance to the Ukraine, and we may wind up with this kind of unending civil war. But I think for the Pentagon's perspective, Western Europe is a growth industry. For those of us that like, you know, light white wine and good, you know, fried food.
Maybe well, speak for thing. Yourself on the fried food and the white wine. Ron, my other higher level takeaway than what I mentioned at the beginning of the question to Jim is the government is notoriously bad at predicting what might happen a year or two or 5 years in the future. And given where we're going all across the government, civilian and military, budget-wise, trying to figure out what the next thing might be becomes infinitely more difficult when you add in all of the budget uncertainty that we've been experiencing the last several years.
Well, and especially, I'll speak to this from a force management perspective. You can't expand and contract the uniformed force that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You can with guard and reserves to some extent, but when you begin changing the basic force structure and drawing it down, which we have been doing for a couple of years, and the civilian tail along with it, both civil servants and contractors, you know, that's a super tanker that's hard to, you know, it's hard to change its course. And because of all of the uncertainty, both globally and with the budget, it's not clear that its course needs to be changed and or how much.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very problematic for somebody that's looking at recruiting levels, again, both military and civilian, and the mix of forces, fighter wings, tanks. The A-10 example is a great one. They're going to have to do the best they can and muddle through with it, but it just makes it that much more complicated.
The argument that you're making sounds similar to, personnel-wise, Jim, sounds similar to the argument that we hear on the Republican side in Congress regarding weapon systems, which is you can't turn them on and turn them off. You can't just decide 5 years after you have said you don't want any more A-10s. Oh, yeah, as a matter of fact, we probably should build a few more or refurb the ones that we have.
Yeah, that's interesting. And we are moving into an environment where regardless of what's going on with these budget decisions, you have new leadership in the House Armed Services Committee. Matt Thorberry is very, very interested in these kind of nuts and bolts reform issues. John McCain is the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who's always had an issue in those issues. And Ash Carter, now back in the department with Bob Work, who also are kind of guys who are very interested in those issues and in how the Pentagon actually runs and works and are actually very kind of interested in these workforce issues. So here you have people who are kind of genuinely interested in kind of real substantive organizational and process change, which is kind of good, interesting, but at a time when you're still going through all this uncertainty about budgets and expansibility and all the rest. So really exciting year coming up.
You mentioned a magic name there that I want to pursue just for a moment within the minute or so that we have left in this segment, and that's Ashton Carter. His progression is fascinating and striking to me. ATL, right, and then Deputy Secretary, and now Secretary of Defense. I mean, he's done all of the top three in that agency.
And in kind of a flash of the eye. Who'd have thunk it?
Yeah, well, but as we saw at his confirmation hearing, he didn't make very many enemies doing any of those jobs. I mean, he pretty much coasted. That's the textbook definition of coasting to confirmation
He's a very responsible technocrat. It's not meant to be a... It's meant to be descriptive. It's mm-hmm. not negative, net
sure.
positive, but that's
understood.
And he's filled that role well. And I think, you know, in comparison to what they've had, I maybe Congress finds that somewhat refreshing.
What do you think the significance is that there's somebody in that job who is interested in the nuts and bolts operations and by all accounts was good at it when he had those two jobs, instead of somebody who is there as kind of in addition to somebody who's there as kind of a CEO, visionary, outward facing face of the franchise?
I know. I look at the calendar and I see how many days are left the administration. I look at what's on the to-do list every day, and I look at the budget uncertainties that they're going through, and I just wonder what you could really, really do with all that interest and concern.
Jim Carafano's choice is the most important federal news story of the week from The Guardian. The headline is Leaders Discuss Crumbling Ukraine Ceasefire as Fighting Continues. And that story and all of our countdown stories linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, Ron Sanders' choice is the most important federal news story of the week wraps up this week's Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown, featuring the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Jim Carafano of Heritage and Ron Sanders of Booz Allen. And Ron, your choice says the most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Obama calls for new cooperation to wrangle the Wild West Internet. And the president going to Palo Alto this week, signing an executive order on information sharing. And that's the core of what our audience cares about, especially in light of the fact that so much of the federal government's cybersecurity infrastructure now lives at the Homeland Security Department, which we're learning from my colleague Jason Miller on federalnewsradio.com, may not be fully operational this time next week if a shutdown happens at DHS. So the federal government's cyber infrastructure and cyber responses and cyber defenses are kind of in the same muddled transition, churn, whatever you want to call it, that a lot of other things are because of the budget and because of all these other uncertainties. At least that's my view. Am I on target there, do you think?
Well, look, my sense is that whatever happens in the budget, the folks who are on the front lines of our cyber defense are essential, and they will report for duty. They'll be on watch. I'm frankly more concerned about the longer term. We talked about the 1.3% pay increase spread like peanut butter across the board. When you focus that on cyber, I love the line from the president, the internet's the Wild Wild West, and the federal government's the sheriff, or many people look to the federal government to be the sheriff. And I think everyone understands that organizations like Cyber Command and DHS protect government networks. I'm not sure everyone realizes that particularly the latter is in the business of protecting critical infrastructure, and that's a multi-syllabic, obscure, bureaucratic way of saying power and water and transportation and all of those things we can't live without. They're all vulnerable. And as I said in the earlier segment, I think the sheriff is increasingly becoming outgunned and undermanned, in part because fairly meager pay raises, in part because of budget uncertainty. But there are lots of other things going on here, uncertain career paths, lack of engagement, you name it, with some exception. And the brand name agencies like NSA and FBI are the exception. And I sleep better at night knowing that. But as a general matter, the federal government's cyber workforce is under great stress. And we got to start worrying about some relief.
The crux of this is a person problem, a people problem, Jim. It's not a budget problem until you really look under the hood, and then it's kind of a budget problem if there's a pay issue there.
Yeah, I don't know. First of all, I got to tell you, is anybody else really kind of freaked out that the answer to the 21st century amazing technology thing that we have, which has never existed in the human race, and the president's solution is to describe it with 19th century kind of metaphors? It kind of freaks me out. If that's the best you can do, a sheriff and a lasso and the Wild West.
I can't say that I thought about it that way.
I think we just got to put all that aside. So, yeah, I do. So now, look, I think, you know, people that just kind of make the cyber workforce issue a budget issue, I do think you're kind of, I do think that is a bit of a misnomer. First of all, one is you're always going to lose. People are going to be able to pay a lot more in the federal government. So if your notion is we don't pay people enough and that's your answer, you're always going to lose in the marketplace. So forget it. Right. So and I think it kind of misses the point. You know, I was in the Army for 25 years. I guess I got paid. Part of the reason why I was there was because I felt I was doing a mission which was important and I had the resources to do that mission and I was accomplishing something. And so I do think that pay matters, but to particularly to a lot of these young people, the opportunity to do exciting work that's productive and meaningful matters too. So how you structure that thing, I think that really matters. And I also think we tend to look if you really want to move forward excite in an exciting way in human capital, you need a few people that are really, really incredible. Rather than recruiting 80,000 guys that have Strayer degrees, so I think if you focus on high talent, high impact, performers. I think that's one thing. If you focus on the scope and the work and the meaningfulness of the job, I think that's something else. But I think if this is just about we need to pay comparable to the civilian marketplace in order to retain and recruit sufficient cyber workforce thing. I just think that's a kind of a not good way to think about the problem.
Ron, the good news is the mission card is one that nobody else has. The federal government is the only one that has it to the level that it does. And we see year after year after year in the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that is important to people who work for the government, and it's important to people who come in. Unfortunately, it's not enough. It's not important enough to the people who are leaving, and we're seeing the quit rate among millennials is just going through the roof.
Well, look, a couple of things. I don't care whether we use the sheriff metaphor or we call them guardians of the galaxy. The fact is the federal government has an important role both with its own systems and networks and with the rest of our nations. And look, you're not going to hear me suggest that all 200,000 federal IT cyber workers ought to get a pay raise. I agree with you that we ought to be looking for high-end talent. And unfortunately, even there where the mission can be the magnet, we're losing out.
Right.
One of the agencies I deal with, and I won't name them, has coined the term regrettable losses. And these are the people that either they couldn't land on campus, they're losing they're at the top 10 campuses and at the top 10% of the graduates, and they're not competitive at that level.
Right.
Or these are people that have gained years of experience in the federal government at the tip of the spear doing exactly the kinds of things we've been talking about, and somebody poaches them, again, because we can't retain at that high end. I don't think these folks that we lose, either on the front end or the back end, are looking to get rich. On the other hand, there does reach a point where if you can't even get close, you're going to lose them. But I would argue that this takes a comprehensive approach. I think that if people begin to recognize that the federal government is the sheriff, and that sheriff is needs bigger guns and more deputies, then we'll start getting at it. It's not one thing. It's a whole bunch of things, and the time has passed to do something about it.
Ron Sanders' choice is the most important federal news story of the week from the New York Times. Obama calls for new cooperation to wrangle the Wild West Internet. You can read it and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Another terrific Federal News Countdown, gentlemen. Ron, as always, great to have you on the program. Jim, excellent first-time effort on the program. Look forward to having you come back
and do it
again. The Federal News Countdown's archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, along with those links to all of the stories on this week's program. And the Federal News Countdown returns next Friday on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio.